You're listening to a feed of the Association of Music Podcasting at musicpodcasting.org.
In 2009, Erk went to the dark side and became a music podcaster. He discovered a wide, wide selection of music. Apart from Dozy Do by Julie the Band, it's now 2010 and Erk comes down the pipe and into your ears. Bigger, stronger and faster. Every Friday, it's Erk FM time. Now here's your host of Erk FM from Channel Erk. Here's Erk!
G'day, I'm Erk, and welcome to episode 71 of Erk FM. Erk FM is my music podcast that comes down the pipe and into your ears at the end of each week, bringing you quality, pod-safe and independent music from Australia and beyond. Normally these episodes come down the pipe and into your ears on Fridays, but for the last few weeks we have been doing interviews also on Tuesdays. And coming to us from the other side of Australia, from the band Horizon, on the line we have Lee. G'day Lee, how are you going?
Good mate, how are you?
Mate, I'm doing super. How's the weather? How's Western Australia treating you at the moment?
The weather has been pretty dry, it's pretty warm, and I think we've got another hot one today. Well, it's only about 31 today, so it's fairly manageable, but it's definitely been warm.
It has been. A lot of our audience are in the UK and the US, and so they're struggling with winter at the moment, so it's always good to mention the weather over here.
Absolutely. Well, we had a 43 or a 44 about a week or so back, so just thinking about that should warm them up a bit.
Yeah, we'll give them some radiant heat. So tell us, mate. Mm. How did you get started into music in the first place?
Mate, I've been doing music really since I was, about as big to hold in your hand, I guess. I started off, I was classically trained from when I was a kid. Grew up learning violin, and I taught myself how to play piano and other instruments and stuff like that. I guess there was sort of never any question what I was going to do with my life, I guess. And, when I got out of high school, I found my way into some recording studios and started producing records for people, and it progressed from there.
And how did Horizon start?
Horizon initially was a studio project that I was working on with a couple of friends of mine that were session players on my other production work. And, as I say, starting out as a studio project, we just got really excited about where it was going and how it was sounding. And we thought, well, let's try it live and all that kind of thing. And once we started playing it live, it was no question. This is what we've got to focus on, and that's what I did. So yeah, that was the genesis of it, I guess.
So for you, what's the difference between playing live and playing in the studio?
Oh, they're very different animals for sure. I mean, obviously, I mean the obvious difference is you get one take, and it's gone forever. Whereas in the studio, I think when you're an experienced studio musician, you actually relax in the studio because you know that you've got all the time in the world to get it right and all that kind of thing. I guess inexperienced musicians sort of feel that feel being in the studio as pressure because you are under the microscope. But once you sort of get a handle on that and you get used to it, you know, you realise that it is a fairly luxurious place to be, because you can, you know, you can fix all those tiny little things up, you know, if you want to. But I guess the main difficulty in the studio is capturing that sort of energy that you capture in a live, or that you feel in a live performance. That's, I guess, the biggest task in the studio, because, you know, if you relax too much, I guess it can become a little bit lukewarm.
And also, what you have to consider in the studio is time is money, so you just can't afford to, you know, sit there for a week when you could be sitting there for 3 days.
Oh, look, absolutely. I mean, I guess I'm a little bit different to most in the fact that, you know, I have the luxury of having my own studio. And yeah, as a record producer, it's makes it a lot easier for me, and I certainly understand, you know, other people having to go into studios and you know, as you say, sort of keep one eye on the clock and try and capture a vibe and be creative and all that kind of thing can certainly be very difficult. But as I say, I think the more you've done it, you know, the more you realise, you know, it's a safe place to be. So. Yeah, so that's you know, where Horizon really sort of sprung from. And the guitarist that I was working with in the studio, he introduced me to Rich, who he and I are partners in the band, and you know, as a bass player. And yeah, he's just a, you know, great energy, great vibe, really sort of pushes the project along. And, you know, from a business point of view, and you know, I do a lot of the writing and all that side of things, yeah, it works out well that way.
And so you've got your debut album coming out soon. Tell us about that.
We do, yeah. The album 33. It's actually a double album. Which is, everybody keeps telling us, too, that's a big undertaking, and, yeah, it was sort of 4 years in the making, we hooked up with some fantastic musos over in Melbourne, a couple of the guys that were playing with, were playing in the Farnham band, and another guy who was working with Vanessa Amorossi, and they're just awesome musos. And we went over and did some shows with them in last June, and we also did a, you know, like a live in the studio DVD recording at Armstrong's in Melbourne, which is, I guess, you know, the Abbey Road of Australia. You know, all the incredible records have been made in there, and just meeting those guys was such a huge thrill. But also, you know, having the opportunity to ask them, you know, look, what do you think? What are your thoughts on the material that we've got? And, you know, if you had to choose an album out of this material, what would you do? And, you know, and the consensus with those blokes was just release it all. It's all, you know, it's all fantastic. Just put it out. So we figured, well, if they reckon we should put it all out, then maybe we should. So we did.
So that must be a huge tick of confidence, because otherwise I'm sure they'd say to you, you know, if it was crap, not to worry about it and, you know, just pick, you know, 10 songs or whatever.
I think they would certainly, you know, they're pretty straightforward. I mean, they're ultra professional. I mean, they're never, you know, they're never going to just sort of bag anything out, just out and out. But they certainly tell you pretty straight what they think about things. And, and yeah, to have such a sort of positive response from those guys was, yeah, absolutely very gratifying and a huge sort of vote of confidence. So, and in saying that, having, you know, actually assembled that record and putting it together the way that we have, you know, the response so far from people has been really positive. So, I'm certainly looking forward to, to more people hearing what we've done.
Speaking of letting people hear what you've done, let's do that right now as a great segue. And let's start with Primitive. Tell us a little bit about that track.
Well, Primitive is the opening track off the record, and it is our current single that we've released to radio. It's a song that I wrote back in 2000 and went through a few incarnations before it finally reached us in its present state. Really lucky to have Brett Garsed playing guitar on this track. He, of course, is one of the guys that had been working with Farnham from the mid-80s, helped record Whispering Jack, and then went off to the States and worked with Nelson. And he's just regarded by, you know, many people across the world as one of the very best guitarists anywhere. You know, I mean, he's up there with the Steve Vais and the Satrianis and these kind of people. And when he had a listen to the track and added his touch to it, it was just made a world of difference. And you know, it's a huge thrill for us to have him playing on it.
So here it is, Primitive by Horizon. You're listening to Irk FM, and on the line from Perth we have Lee Bradshaw from Horizon, and the song we just heard was Primity from their debut album 33, coming out hopefully by the time you hear this, depending on when you hear it. That's interesting with podcasting, because of people could be hearing this 2-3 years later, and you know you guys might have another album out, who knows.
Well, I should hope we'd have a couple more out by then.
So, that's good.
I'm sure it'll be good for the fans.
Indeed. So you're a songwriter as well, and I always like to pick people's brains when it comes to songwriting. How do you come up with your ideas?
Oh, that's definitely a curly one. Look, it's one of those things that... there's never any set in stone, concrete way that that I do things. I mean, I write music and lyrics, and I guess coming from a classical background, sometimes it's enough just to have, there might be a rhythmic concept. I mean, there's a song on the record, "I'll Be King," which just starts with a drum, boom, ba, boom, ba, and that was enough to sort of, I guess, get the juices flowing and sort of encourage the song to come out that way. It's one of those things which might sound a little bit unusual, but, you sort of really feel like, you really just feel like a conduit when it happens, and it's sort of hard to say where a lot of that sort of stuff comes from. A lyric idea could just be a line, could be an overall concept. As I say, it could be a melody, musical idea, and they often come to you at the most inopportune times, but you just have to say thank you and get on with it.
So if it does come to you at an inopportune time, let's say you're out and about, or it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you happen to be asleep, how do you get the idea down so you can work on it later?
I always just write it down. My house is house and office and studio is covered in bits of paper with musical ideas written all over them. So that's usually the way that I do it. Just bang it down in a bit of paper and then it's there, and I don't have to sort of worry about filing it away in the brain and trying to remember it later, because there's so much music in there all the time, it can get a little bit crowded. So that's what I do.
It's interesting you say that, because that's a bit old school, which is fine, and obviously works for you. Some of the other bands...
A lot of people say it's very old school, but I'll never use a computer to write anything down. I think there's something really organic about that process of just, having manuscript paper and a pen, and you just bang it down, and you sort of don't... I think if I sort of had a mouse in my hand and was, clicking notes on a screen in a notation program, I'd be using too much of my brain. I don't know if I've freed up enough of it to work properly if I'm multitasking too much.
Because some of the other bands that I've been speaking with, they've mentioned, if they're out and about or whatever, they'll just grab their mobile phone and just use the voice recorder in that. Some of them actually carry around voice recorders just in case they have an idea, and so they can either sing or say the words into the voice recorder and then come back to it later.
Yeah, right. I have certainly entered some lyrics into a text message and saved on my phone before, but never used it as a voice recorder. So that's a good idea. I'll keep that one in mind in case I'm really stuck sometime.
Well, you never know when you're about. You never know when inspiration appears. I've interviewed singer songwriters and also book authors, and some of the places where they have the ideas, it's amazing.
Absolutely, yeah, I can imagine. As I say, sometimes, you might be sitting on the toilet and you get the best idea you've had in your life, and that's probably the most inopportune time.
Yes, exactly right. So tell us a little bit about performing live. What sort of physical and mental preparations do you do on the day of a gig?
Well, I mean, whenever we've got shows, you know, we always make sure that, you know, I mean, it's really important for us to present the material the very best way that we can. So I guess what's involved in that is that there's lots of rehearsing beforehand. I mean, I do a lot of personal preparation in isolation, making sure that my voice is in condition and that, you know, that I get from one end of the set to the other. It's pretty strenuous material. I mean, we cover, I mean, obviously all our Horizon material, but we also do, you know, a version of Led Zeppelin's Black Dog, which sort of takes you way up into the stratosphere vocally. And when people come to a show and they expect to hear that kind of material, they don't want to see somebody sort of screaming their guts out and not hitting notes and things like that. So I do a lot of personal preparation and try and stay fit and eat well and all that kind of thing. The myth of the rock and roller, you know, smoking and drinking and doing all that kind of thing is it's certainly not the case with me anyway. I try and stay pretty fit and healthy. I mean, I'm not a, you know, not a muscle man or anything like that, but I do go to the gym because when you get through, you know, 15 numbers, you know, you can be pretty exhausted, but as Chet would say, the spirit of rock will generally lift you, but you certainly got to be prepared to walk the walk when the time comes to do it, that's for sure.
And so what's your view of the live scene? How's that looking for you at the moment?
Well, it depends on what part of the country we're talking about. I mean, I've only had a little experience of live music outside of Australia, and we've been focused mostly in the last 18 months on Melbourne. But before that, we did a lot of shows over here in Perth with our Western Australian lineup. And look, the scene here it's an interesting one, the Western Australian scene, in that there's so many talented musicians here and great bands. I feel that it's culturally largely unsupported. You have a sort of very small, devoted group of people that attend sort of live original music over here, and that's fantastic. But it's certainly a lot different to what it was 15 or 20 years ago when, you might have a band like the Jets, who are a huge Western Australian band at the time. And, I mean, they were primarily a cover band, I should say. But when you've got those guys putting 500-600 people in a venue every time and then having a line around the block, people wanting to get in, that sort of thing just doesn't happen here anymore. And I understand it's the same sort of thing in Melbourne. You know, venues are closing, and the venues that are remaining are obviously being flooded by bands trying to find an opportunity to perform. So it sounds pretty bleak, but it's not. I mean, I guess the venues that are still there, obviously, you know, you've got places like the Esplanade and St Kilda, which is, you know, a fantastic place, and it's always packed, and, you know, there's always good bands there. And obviously downstairs they've got their Gershwin Room, which is, you know, where they film Rock Quiz. And so there are some brilliant venues. It's just a shame that there isn't more, I guess. So that's probably how I see things. I mean, I don't know whether it's going to change or what, or whether it's going to continue sort of doing what it's doing. But it seems to me that even your touring acts that are coming through, looking outside the square in terms of places to perform. I mean, it's why you've got things like A Day on the Green, where you've got major touring acts coming through and setting up in wineries and things like that. To me, it's an indication that there is, there are a lack of venues here. So,
once upon a time, you'd see some of the acts coming through and they were guaranteed places like the Sydney Entertainment Centre and, Telstra Dome or whatever they call it this week in Melbourne. But now, as you said, you see them in wineries in the Hunter Valley, and you think, 10 years ago, yes, the only place in Sydney they would go would be, yep, the Entertainment Centre or maybe the Horden Pavilion or maybe Metro. They
absolutely
wouldn't even consider it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I saw, we have a venue over here. It's the Burswick Casino that we have here, but it has a handful of venues inside that complex. Obviously, the Dome, which is probably the largest venue that we've got here in Western Australia, which, it's not a great sounding venue, but they do have a fantastic room in there called the Burswick Theatre, but it's a roughly 2,000 seat venue, and when you go in there to see an act like Alice Cooper, who you expect to be in a large venue with a large crowd, it's different, to sort of sit in a theatre and watch, I guess, one of classic rock's ultimate icons. It's strange, it's very, very strange. But I certainly know what you're saying, and I mean, we had a fantastic entertainment centre here in Perth, which has been closed for, I think, the better part of 10 years now, and it's just a political thing over here. I mean, we've got Challenge Stadium, which is a really good venue, but it's pretty small. It's only about 3,500 people, to my knowledge, and there's just so many people crying out for them to reopen the Ent Centre and sort of really have a great sounding indoor venue available to touring acts, and it's hard enough for a lot of these international acts to justify the cost of coming across the country to Western Australia, I think having a venue like that up and running again would be significant in changing that, and I'm not sure what the situation's like over in Sydney. I know Melbourne's got obviously Rod Laver and there are, you've got the Palais, which is a smaller sort of venue, but it's really classy, good sounding room. But yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting to see sort of what's important to the people in charge.
It's interesting when you mentioned Alice Cooper playing at a small venue like that. The old stereotype of Alice Cooper having it up to 11, but surely in a venue like that with, 2,500-3,000 people, it could probably turn it down to 7.5 and still sound like 11.
Well, it definitely sounded like 11, but, you could never imagine back in, 1975 or 76, somebody telling the management of Alice Cooper that, there was a performance curfew and things like that. But he certainly would have had to have played by the rules in the Burswick Theatre. And it's just, like I said, it's interesting because it does, it certainly does give you an insight into what's important, to the policymakers and the decision makers in government, and I mean, these ultimately are the people that are responsible for the health of culture in our country, because they'll either support it or they won't, and the general punters are not always catered to, unfortunately. So interesting though.
So we move from the live scene and, venues closing down and, harder to get into bigger venues and that sort of stuff. You've really got to be able to basically fill the place before you think about getting in there. How has the online world helped you with the internet and social networking and all of that sort of thing?
I think the whole online thing has been a double-edged sword in many ways. I mean, there are, of course, some fantastic pluses in that great music has become sort of cross-generational now. You've got, you know, you might have young kids who are listening to Wolf Mother, and they you know, log on to their MySpace page and see that their influences are Led Zeppelin and Deep Purple, and they go, oh, who are they? And they click on, you know, click onto their MySpace pages, and they, you know, and they hear Smoke on the Water or, you know, Black Knight and Black Dog or Kashmir or something like that, and they go, oh my God, this is awesome, you know. So, you know, from that way, you know, these sort of younger generations are being exposed to much more music, and it's not sort of, I guess when we were growing up, we were dictated to more by what was on the radio. But by the same token, I guess the negative of that is that everybody anywhere has a platform to put their music out, and you know, I guess the uninitiated, you know, they just decide whether they like it or not. So you could have somebody, you know, in their bedroom recording something with a, you know, $20 microphone and a Casio keyboard and putting it online and having an online facade that that this is something that's been produced in a, you know, in a major studio with a record producer and a budget and all that kind of thing. And you know, from my point of view, you know, I think the in past years that you know, the hierarchy of labels and you know, studios and having record producers working with artists and A&R people developing, you know, repertoire with artists and all that kind of thing. I mean, I know a lot of people sort of talk about the big bad record companies, but you know, the reality of it is, you know, that sort of standard of quality control, I think, has resulted in some incredible records being made. And, you know, all the great bands, you know, Zeppelin through to Deep Purple, the Beatles, you know, Elton John, Billy Joel, you name it, they all worked with record companies, and these are all, you know, classic records. And I think the fact that that hierarchy has sort of slowly been dissolved in recent years has, well, it just, you know, a lot more mediocrity, I guess, has slipped through the cracks. That might be a bit of a controversial thing to say, but I think a lot of people in the industry would agree that that there's a lot of stuff out there that probably never would have seen the light of day, you know, had more than one person been able to express an opinion on it. So I guess that's the negative side of the online thing. Of course, the networking side of it is has sort of empowered artists to, you know, to develop a fan base and create a fan base on their own without the budgets of a major label and all that kind of thing. So there is an element of people power to it, but that also works. That also works against artists as well, because for the same reasons I was explaining before, everybody's in there and everybody's trying to get a fan. And you know, your punters sort of become complacent about, you know, ad requests from bands. You know, you might log into your MySpace and have, you know, 10 requests to be a friend of a band, and you know, 99.9% of the time, most people just go approve, and don't even bother going to the band's page to listen to their music. So, in that sense, it's a, you know, the whole thing's pretty redundant. So, yeah, it's a bit of a rabbit warren that the whole online thing, in my opinion. I mean, from my point of view, you know, I do what I'm good at, which is making music. I'm not good at you know, working MySpace and doing all that kind of thing. We've sort of got a team of people that help us with all that side of things, and I know it's something that you have to do, but you know, I guess as I say, I'm in a position where I'm a little bit more fortunate than some of the other people sort of starting out, in that I do have people that can help me to do that. You know, other people, you know, they have to do it on their own, and it probably in reality takes time away from making music, which at the end of the day is probably not a good thing.
And there's a whole heap of people who can't afford to do this full time, me included, and so you're doing this around a day job.
Exactly. And so I guess, I guess it's, really for me it just boils down to being a double-edged sword, and I'm not sure, I really don't know how the industry is going to move forward. I know that I know that record companies are getting quite radical in their approach to controlling intellectual property online. I know that IINet, which is an internet service provider, is being sued by several film companies because they can't find every individual internet user that's downloaded a torrent. So they figure, well, we'll just sue the provider. We've got to find a way to curb that kind of thing somehow. And I think that the whole online issue has been quite a can of worms for the entertainment industry, full stop.
And then of course you've got the whole, won't somebody think of the children, the whole Great Wall of Rudd thing that I've been speaking about for the last year and a half, but that's a totally different issue. Although then again it could come on to the music world as well, with the internet filter that the government's thinking of doing, and
it is a different issue, and it sort of it crosses over into that argument of how much sort of violence and sex and all that sort of stuff should people be exposed to, it's particularly children, of course, and that's another thing altogether. I'm not personally a fan of censorship, so I can't get that word out this early in the morning. not always a big fan of censorship, but I am an advocate for probably parents taking more responsibility for ensuring that their children are watching and listening to material that's, age appropriate, because young impressionable people coming up can sometimes take things that are, from an artistic point of view, meant to be metaphoric, literally, and therefore get a whole different meaning out of that expression, which is designed to come over as something totally different. So, that's another tricky one. The censorship thing with the internet filter. Again, it comes back to the point that I made before. I think it's going to be more. I think it's going to be more indicative of the frame of mind of the policy makers and the decision makers. What are they going to filter? What's going to be left out? What's going to be left in? And whether or not it's actually going to make any difference, I don't know.
And the money that they're spending there, they could be spending on things like, I don't know, reopening the Perth Entertainment Centre.
Exactly. That'd be fantastic. Or, perhaps, doing what they had talked about doing several years ago and actually having a decent broadband service across the country.
Yes, that would indeed be very handy, considering how things are going over the internet and, things like music and podcasting and all of that sort of thing. So what's on the horizon for Horizon? I'm glad you like that
one. Very good segue, I like that. the next the next trip to Melbourne, we're going over to to do some meetings with distributors and management, and obviously catch up with the boys who are Melbourne based, and we're really just sort of waiting to see when Primitive hits the radio and how it goes in terms of people's response to that. And we'll have to go and tour and perform in support of that, and obviously the album release to follow. And then I guess a permanent relocation to Melbourne sometime in 2010. And away we go. That's essentially it. I'm started writing material for the next record, which is great, and it's always exciting for me. So we'll probably in between performing and doing all that kind of thing, start tracking and get that one locked away. So when the time comes, it's ready to roll out.
Awesome. So why don't we finish up with the song that we were talking about before, I Will Be King. Tell us a little bit about that.
I'll Be King was actually the very first song that we recorded for the project. It was, when it was still just a record producer's, Alan Parsons Project style studio thing. And it was really, it was a song that I had written with a band that I was doing some bits and pieces with in around 2004, 2005. We did a couple of gigs and didn't really work out, but a couple of the songs that we wrote I thought were really strong, and this was one of them. And given the fact that we were in the studio and we're just, it was a bit of a free-for-all, let's just do whatever we want. Listening to Queen and there's a bit of the little rock you thing happening there, and with all the backing vocal blocks, there's a lot of sort of inspiration from there, and then, the heavy guitar riffs, which are, I guess sort of reminiscent of the Deep Purple thing, and then you've got, some of the vocal qualities of a Bad Company kind of vibe happening, and we really just were excited, creatively excited about the whole prospect, as I say, it was the first track that we put together for the record, so it, I guess paved the way and pointed out a direction for all the other material that was to follow.
Awesome. So, Lee, thanks for joining us, mate. It's been an absolute pleasure. We'll finish
my
off...
My pleasure. I hope I've made sense this early in the morning. I think I may have spun off on a couple of long tangents there, but hopefully we haven't put anybody to sleep.
No, that's all right. And that's one of the ideas of having these interview shows separate to the main show. I personally enjoy these interviews, especially coming from a talk podcaster background. So it's been a lot of fun. And here is the song, I Will Be King. I don't know who will be the king, but this is, of course, Horizon. Lee, thanks for joining us. And here, as we say on IRC FM, good night, Interweb.
Chance to have my Now they want to know me. Now they want to show me. Now they want to touch me. Now they want to be me. Now they think they own me. Now they think they know me. I thought they might love me. I guess I was
You have been listening to a Channel Irk production. Channel Irk and all 5 podcasts are licensed under a Creative Commons non-commercial, non-derivative, share-alike license registered in Australia. Music is used with direct permission or under agreements with various music providers. All rights to the music contained within remains with the original rights holder. Some sound effects are sourced from the Free Sound Project under Creative Commons. For more information about Channel Irk, go to www.channelirk.com.